When Bob St. Meyer and I started St. Meyer and Hubbard in late 2000, we didn't have many clients, so we had a lot of time on our hands. And my wife picked up a book for me, and she said, "This is really philosophically very close to what you believe that bankers should be doing and what you should be doing for St. Meyer and Hubbard clients." So I wasn't a big reader for most of my life, but I started to read this book, The Trusted Advisor, and it was game-changing and life-changing. One of the co-authors of that book is Charles Green. And so I have this crazy thing that I do. I read a great book that I like, and I reach out to the author, and I want to talk to him and find out what was behind the book, why they wrote it, what was the impetus for it, how's it going. And so I reached out to Charlie by email, and before you know it, we became fast business friends, and we've talked often. I've had Charles speak at the bank that I'm on the board of directors of. I've had him speak for St. Meyer and Hubbard. He's done several webinars. I've written articles for his great blog, Trust Matters. And so we're bringing him back because I saw an article recently, a post that Charlie did called The 6 Essential Facts About Trust and Professional Relationship. And I thought, you know, Charlie would be perfect for a 10 minutes with to talk about this particular subject. And so we're thrilled that Charlie was able to do this. Charlie's a graduate of Columbia University in New York with a BA in philosophy and an MBA from the Harvard Business School. So he comes well matriculated and well experienced. He spent many, many years at Gemini Consulting, and now with his own business, Trusted Advisor Associates, helps companies around the world build trust and keep it. So Charlie, welcome to 10 Minutes With. We're absolutely thrilled to have you.
Jack, thank you for having me on this 10 Minutes program. I'm excited. Good to talk to you again.
Great to have you, Charlie. It's always terrific to talk with you. And I think a lot of people need to hear what you're talking about and all the new things that are going on in trust. It was really interesting. I think of you often when I see articles from other people that do trust. And of course, as you all know, Charles Green was one of the co-authors of The Trusted Advisor. But I saw the Edelman Trust Barometer in January, and it continues to be challenging, Charlie. And you've got a lot of things that you can continue to talk to folks about.
Yes, that's true. I think it's, trust is a growth business or whatever, because distrust is increasing. So it's worthwhile listening to everybody.
Well, great to have you. Thanks again. And you've got a lot of great things you want to talk about today.
Sure. Well, let's dive into it then. You picked up on this infographic that we came out with lately, and maybe that serves as a good kind of organizing principle for making a couple of points. One of them is one of the many myths about trust is that trust takes time. We often say that, trust takes time, and we all nod our heads like it does. Actually, it really doesn't. With one notable exception, the establishment of trust is something that happens pretty quickly. It's between people, and it happens in moments, in sort of step functions, not as a crude natural process over time. It happens when you create a sense of intimacy or an instant sense of credibility, or you demonstrate, your ability to be focused on the other person. So it really doesn't take time. It takes courage to sort of reach out and establish that connection. Now, the one exception, which is interesting, is reliability, which is one part of trust. And by definition, reliability requires the accumulation of instances of activities, of repeated instances of reliability, and that requires the passage of time. So with that one exception, it generally doesn't take time. It takes courage.
You know, that's really interesting. I remember when I first talked with you, it was early 2001. The Trusted Advisor had recently come out, and you and I talked by phone. I sent you an email. You and I talked by phone, and there seemed to be a connection, and we've talked over the years, etc. But I'm curious. I'm sure there are many others who reached out to you by phone or email or said, "Hey, Charlie, love to chat with you." And my question around trust can be built quickly is, after doing this for so many years, How do you get a sense of when you're just talking to somebody on the phone, if you okay, this is a trustworthy person?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that I actually remember that call, and I think it had been preceded by a couple of emails, and my reaction was, I don't know, maybe he's interesting, maybe not. And then we got on the phone, and you're right, I don't remember exactly what was said, but I had the sense of, wow, this guy's for real. He's not blowing smoke. He knows what he's talking about. His interest is genuine, and he's a, you know, sounds like a trustworthy guy, certainly worth meeting, which we then did. And I think that's sort of prototypical. If you think about it, a conversation, especially face-to-face, but even on the phone, that's a pretty high bandwidth interaction as opposed to email or letters or credentials. And I think, you know, if you think about it, human beings are the result of eons of evolution. We're social animals, and we become very, very good at discerning and gaining insight about the person across the table from us. So when we engage with each other, it's not the kind of thing you can necessarily download into a spreadsheet or make a list of checkable behavioral checkpoints. But, you know, there's loads of interaction going on in a conversation. And I think we intuitively, subconsciously come to rather rapid conclusions about whether this person is trustworthy or whether we want to engage with them. So I think nothing has changed since you and I talked that first time.
But what about this intimacy? That's fascinating to me.
Yes.
I think sometimes people get the wrong impression of what that means, but it says here that it's the most influential factor in building trust. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes. Let me back up that claim. First of all, the four factors in the trust equation, credibility, reliability, intimacy, and low self-orientation. When we first wrote that in the book, The Trusted Advisor, in 2000, we had kind of assumed, we weren't really thinking mathematically, we just thought this is a cool depiction. And we kind of assumed that the denominator factor, standing there by itself, self-orientation, was probably the most powerful one. In any case, that's the point we wanted to make. Well, some years later, I decided to actually quantify that, and we got 70,000 people to take an online version of the trust equation. We call it the trust quotient, or TQ, like EQ and IQ. And when we got all this data and we examined it and drew several conclusions, one of which is this one. If you run a regression equation with trustworthiness as a dependent variable, it turns out that the one, the highest coefficient, the highest explanatory value of all those four factors turned out to be intimacy. So when I say it's the strongest, most powerful component, I mean that literally and statistically. It shows up as the biggest driver of trustworthiness, at least in the way that we've defined it. And what it has to do with, it's sort of a soft skill. It basically has to do with a sense of security that other people have talking with us. It's the sense that I can share certain things with this person and feel okay about it. They're not going to abuse me. They're not looking to gain edge on me. They're actually paying attention to me. They seem genuinely curious about me. They seem interested in a relationship rather than a transaction. And feeling that, we become willing to engage with those people, to share things with them, and in return, to share things about ourselves. So with some overlapping concepts would be vulnerability, empathy. Those are the kinds of things that are entailed in that notion of intimacy.
And it's really interesting. You write so well, and you have a variety of different blogs and articles. And whenever I see something on LinkedIn, I always repost it and share it with people. And one of the things you came up with recently was this whole idea of question obsession. And I think it goes probably in a lot of the factors, but this whole idea of intimacy, if I feel connected to you, the questions that I ask, the conversation is just going to flow so much better versus
right.
Your article's point of asking this question, then this question, then this question, et cetera.
Yes. Yeah, those of us, I mean, in business, we've sort of been trained everywhere you look, whether it's business school or online courses or textbooks or speeches we go to. And then one of the general messages is you're supposed to be brilliant. You're supposed to have insights. Ahead of time, before you have a conversation, think of a bunch of cool questions. And those questions are usually aimed at either demonstrating how smart you are
or at exploring some kind of hypothesis that's going to result in a brilliant conclusion, again, showing how smart you are. And the fact is, as you just mentioned, if you really are engaged with that person, interested in them, curious about them, you're not going to walk in with a preset list of questions that you're going to execute. It's good to have that preset list of questions. I'm not saying you should walk in unplanned, but you should be willing to toss them away at the moment's notice, depending on where the conversation goes. What I'm really talking about is reframing, repurposing the intent of those questions. And the intent shouldn't be just to show how smart you are or to elaborate some hypothesis. It ought to be to show genuine curiosity and interest in that other person and in their business situation. And if that's your intent, then you're going to go where the conversation goes. And that creates intimacy.
That's interesting. This number three is fascinating to me. And I'm curious, it talks about balance, and I'm sure you'll discuss it. But one of the things that's always interested me in the sales process is whether it's a Myers-Briggs or a social styles or whatever, people right. even receive information in kind of a different way. And we talk about it in terms of flexibility. Your ability to be flexible as a social style makes you be able to hit the mark with all kinds of different people. How does that relate, Charlie, to what you're talking about here, which is this whole idea of balance across personal traits?
Well, I think it's somewhat related. What we're talking about here is an interesting statistical finding that came out of looking at those 70,000 data points, and it was this, that if you there's several ways to get to a combined score. Let's say your score is 7.1. Well, you can get there by being very strong in credibility and weak in intimacy, or vice versa, any different combinations. But what we noticed was that on average, the closer you were in your four scores, the lower the standard deviation between them, the higher the total score was. And that's not any leftover trait of the arithmetic. That's actually, there's a difference there. And I think what it is that we trust people who are sort of whole, balanced, complete, integral, integrated. If you think about it, suppose somebody who's highly reliable, good on intimacy skills, low self-orientation, but they're bad on credibility. You can't trust what they say. We have a word for that. It's called windbag. And if somebody is good on the other three dimensions but bad on reliability, you can't depend on them. We have a word for that. They're a flake. You can't, you know, those are not the guys you send to pick up somebody at the airport. If somebody's weak on intimacy, even if they're strong on the other ones, then they're cold fish, you know, that kind of thing. And if somebody's bad on self-orientation, even if they're good on the others, we're skeptical about their motives. We're suspicious of them. They don't seem right. So in a lot of other areas in business, you hear, you know, strength finder, those kinds of things that basically say leverage your strengths and don't worry so much about your weaknesses. Well, when it comes to trust, the opposite is true. You need to worry about your weakness. You need to bring it up to the level of the others. Because I think people that have one glaring defect across these four, we see them as unintegrated, somehow off balance, something is wrong. So I think that's a little bit related to the point you made about being flexible. But I think it's a slightly different point as well.
And one of the interesting things about any of these surveys and data points and you know all of that is, okay, if I know, I'll think with my mouth open and say, if I know I'm an unbalanced person, I don't mean it that way.
Right.
But if I'm an unbalanced person and I know that credibility, for example, is a real weak point of mine, what can I do, right. Charlie, to make that better?
You can do two things. First of all, you can be honest about it, particularly with credibility. It's very disarming to be able to say, look, this is what I know and this is what I don't know. Your ability to demonstrate your knowledge of your lack of knowledge helps a lot. That's called candor and that's called transparency. In fact, one of the most trust-creating things you can say is, I don't know. Which, of course, is completely paradoxical given all the messages we get in business. You're supposed to be an expert. You're supposed to know. So that's one. You know, be brutally honest and open and transparent about what you don't know. The other thing you can do is, let's again, to take your example, if you don't know that much, even if you try just a little bit, it'll become very evident that you're not an expert in medicine, for example, as soon as you start talking, assuming you're not a doctor. But if you demonstrate a willingness and an interest in trying to get a little better, you get credit for that too. So people whose weakness is intimacy, often they're afraid, you know, I'm an interior person, I'm an introvert. Hey, you get credit for trying. People can sense if you're trying to push, you know, off of your home ground a little bit, and you get credit for trying.
Well, this makes me feel good. At age 68, at the time we're recording, sometimes my family will say, "Well, you're an old curmudgeon," or you know, my grandchildren say that I'm old and what have you. I'm
right.
Pleased that trust improves with age, Charlie. Talk about that one a little bit.
Yeah, that's actually the strongest correlation in the database. That one just jumped right out. And again, this is the TQ trust quotient is a self-assessment survey. So it's conceivable that we're all lying to ourselves, but I don't think so. I think that I would ask anybody listening to this, ask yourself, am I now, today, whatever age I am, more or less trustworthy than when I was 19? And I think most of us will sort of laugh and say, oh my God, of course, you know. It comes partly with, there are a couple of things that come with age. One obviously is experience. And with every year that passes, you know, you, Jack, get exactly 1 year older and 1 year more experienced. And on average, everybody else doesn't, which means, you know, with every passing year, you gain knowledge, you gain perspective. I also think this is a gross generalization, but with age, most of us get a little more, forgiving, a little more less inclined to get hot under the collar about something. We get a little better perspective, and we don't get too, you know, jazzed up about things that we used to. And that's a great virtue, the ability to sort of be calm about things, just see what's going on and not get all wrapped up in the moment. I can't prove that one with data, but I think it's fairly true.
Well, I can prove it anecdotally. I can, you know, any parent who's out there listening to this has experienced this with their children. If they go to a restaurant and their kid is acting up a little bit, or even if they're not and they make a mistake and they spill water, a lot of times parents will get very upset. Grandparents go, well, they'll make more water. Let's clean it up. It's not as big of a deal. I'll tell you a quick story. We went into a ball game last year. We went to Wrigley Field. And my two grandchildren were there, and they were seven at the time. And so we went to a restaurant, and one of my grandchildren spilled my beer, and he spilled it on my phone. And of course, Adam was the father was like, "Oh my gosh, you know, wasn't gonna hit him or anything like that." I said, "Look, they'll make more beer, and my phone will dry." And Gavin felt bad about it. And you know, it was really interesting, Charlie, is how he looked at both of us and said, "How are the people going to react?" And
yes,
you know, that, so that is really interesting, and it's good to see that trust improves with age. That's good for bank presidents to know, Charlie.
Yes, that is.
And speaking of bank presidents, there are more and more women bank presidents, which is a good thing now, which leads
a great thing.
Number five.
Yes, absolutely. And this one, interestingly, this one's becoming more controversial in today's age of political correctness. Depending on the audience I'm talking to, I have to be very careful about phrasing this one. But so let me take a bit. The survey shows that the average trust quotient score reflected by people is statistically significantly different for women than it is for men, and by about 1.5 standard deviations. It's more than an accident. And if you unpack it, very interestingly, most of that difference, 60-70% of the difference of women over men, is due to women overperforming on one of those four variables: credible, reliable, intimate, low self-orientation. And if your audience wants to guess, you're probably right. It's intimacy. Women tend to score more highly on the intimacy factor than men to a much greater extent, and that affects the whole equation. And as we mentioned on the first point, intimacy is the strongest variable. There's a confirming piece of data that I find very informative, which is that if you look at Pew, Gallup, Yankelovich, they all do polls on most and least trustworthy professions. They've done these for years. And with one exception, the year 2002, where firemen came out the most trustworthy profession. Notice that was the year after 9/11. But the year after that, it went back to where it had been before and has remained ever since. The most trustworthy profession on all these surveys is, drum roll, nursing. Now, what's interesting about that, nursing is predominantly, not entirely, but predominantly a female profession, 89% in the U.S., although there it's changing too, which is a good thing. And I think if you, more importantly, if you had to say, is there one trait of these four trust components that nursing best represents? Absolutely, it's intimacy. You know, we are, I like to say we are figuratively and literally naked in front of nurses, and they make it okay. There's even a credibility spin over. If a doctor says to you, you're going to be up and walking in 2 weeks, and the nurse comes to you and says, honey, it's going to be a month, you know, guess who you believe? So all that adds up, you know, nursing, intimacy, highest factor in regression equation, female dominant profession, it all adds up and makes sense here. Women are more trustworthy in, again, in the ways that we have defined in the trust equation here, which, you know, suggests that the trend toward diversity, gender diversity, more women in banking is a good thing. And I, you know, anecdotally, intuitively think that's true as well. It's a plus.
Yeah, it is a plus. And number six, expertise. This bodes well, and I think we've got there's a crisis in banking, and a lot of people are willing to talk about it, and some aren't. And the crisis is we have a lot of 45 to 68 to 70 year old bankers who have a lot of experience, but there's this real gap in the middle, and even at the beginning, where there isn't as much expertise. But your findings are that you don't necessarily have to have 30 years in banking for the customer to trust you, and that's number six.
That's absolutely right. Narrowly, again, in the terms of the equation, credibility ranks, you know, third or fourth out of the four variables. More substantively, it is in banking, more broadly in financial services, but also across all business, we tend to put more emphasis on expertise. We look at credibility, we look at credentials, we look at, you know, have you got the following certifications? Show me your white papers, show me your track record, et cetera. The role of expertise, I'm not saying it's unimportant, but the role is important to understand. When clients are making decisions or feeling influenced, we tend to think it's because, oh my gosh, this guy's really smart and credible. That's not really how it happens. The role of credibility is twofold. It gets you in the door. It's like a resume. It makes somebody say, this person seems really smart and experienced and well-credentialed. I think I want to talk to them. That's what a resume does for you. It gets you the job interview. And after the fact, credibility also plays a role. If somebody says, well, I chose this bank and this banker, they're not likely to say, you know, if a friend says, well, why? Or especially in the B2B world, if somebody says, why did you choose them? You're not going to say, well, I kind of liked them, you know, we got along well. No, that seems, you know, way too trivial to confess to people. Instead, we say, well, they're qualified, they're smart, they got credentials, big bank behind them, blah, blah, blah. The fact is that moment of decision-making, the moment of getting the sale, the moment of saying, wow, I trust this person, is very much driven by intimacy and low self-orientation and all the soft stuff. So credibility, expertise gets you in the door. It also grants you the excuse, the rationalization for the decision you made. But the decision itself, the meat in the sandwich, if you will, is much more driven by these soft, interpersonal, subconscious, intuitive kinds of factors. So that's how I look at it.
Well, it's great stuff. And I, you know, I always try to ask my guests questions that maybe the audience might ask. So I'm gonna again try to think with my mouth open, because we're always in political times, but these are challenging times. We've got elections coming up in 18, we've got presidential elections coming up in 20. And I guess if somebody was in front of you, they might say, Charlie, I would guess that politicians are probably pretty low on the trust scale, but everything that they say and do isn't untrustworthy. How do I separate, Charlie, from somebody that does 14 things wrong, but still votes two things on their conscience, and it's a pretty good. Does that make them totally untrustworthy, or how do you see the whole politics thing of this?
Well, that's really complicated. It's a complicated question, and it's an important one. And I guess the one observation I'd make is that politicians get a bad rap in one way. They are at the bottom of all the trust lists for all the reasons you mentioned. But if you think about it, part of the job of a politician, a good politician, what they're supposed to do is figure out compromise. They're supposed to learn how to forge agreements with opposing parties. And part of our problem is, in the era of politics that we're in now, is compromise has become a dirty word. And we've decamped into our little tribes, and we shout ideological labels at each other. And we keep electing people who think their job is to go reflect those differences. And unfortunately, that has, in a funny way, that has a high impact negatively on trust. Because we've come to think that if a politician says one thing, but they say something else, or if they change their position, somehow that's a bad thing. And the truth is, if you've got, one point of view on 27 different issues and you never change them, we don't want you in office. That's the wrong kind of person to have in politics. So I think we all need as citizens to get a little better educated about not confusing hard ideological positions with what we should be expecting of politicians. So I'm not answering your question directly, but I think that's the meat of what we need to think about when we think about trust in politics.
Yeah, we could probably spend another hour talking about the media and social media and all that. And the fact is, when you and I were growing up, especially me, I guess, you saw the Daily
Paper. A year behind you.
you saw the Daily Paper the next day, and so you don't have this level of immediacy and 24/7 kind of stuff. Well, right. you talked about the last thing I wanted to ask you. You talked about your trust quotient, and I've taken it, and it's really fascinating. So, if somebody wanted to get one, Charlie, how would they go about doing that?
Well, we have a free version and a paid version, and you don't have to decide which one you want until you finish taking it. You can go to our website, which is trustedadvisor.com, trustedadvisor.com. And if you look in the upper right corner of the website, you will see, I forget the exact words, but it's take the trust quotient, take the TQ. It's fairly evident. Top right corner of the website. Click on it, and it'll give you right online the 20 questions. It'll take you 3 or 4 minutes to complete it. And you instantly get, a two-page version of the answers. And if you want to give us a credit card or PayPal, we'll give you 15 more pages of analysis for $30, I think it is.
Well, speaking of giving, let me give you all a little piece of advice. I'm fortunate to be on the board of directors of a community bank, and we from time to time have speakers come out, and we've had a lot of speakers, but Charles Green is by far the most popular. And if any of you out there need to have a speaker that just will wow your crowd, tell you the truth, and make you think, and then go back and say, let me try some of these things. It really does work. So Charlie, my son, when we were going to record this, he said, "Dad, there's no way you and Charles Green can do this in 10 minutes." And he was right.
Yeah, you're right. That's right.
And I'm glad. It's always great to talk to you, Charlie, and so thrilled that you were able to do it. Thanks.
Oh, thank you, Jack. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks, Charlie. Great to connect with you again, and so thrilled and privileged that you honored us by being on 10 Minutes With today. A lot of great practical stuff in the area of trust, which we need to continue to work on. As Charlie mentioned, his great tool called the Trust Quotient is available, and you can get that at his website. You can also find his amazing blog, Trust Matters, on his website, and that is trustedadvisor.com. Charlie can speak at your event, which he is phenomenal at, do a conference call with your colleagues or a sales meeting, and many, many other kinds of things. But you should for sure follow him on Twitter and follow him on LinkedIn as well. Charlie can be reached at, and he actually responds, at cgreen@trustedadvisor.com. When I say he actually responds, you know, there's a lot of best-selling authors who have written several books, and Charlie's written three, that will just drop you like a hot potato and never respond to any request for outreach or email. Charlie's different. He believes very much in intimacy and working with people and getting them better. So again, cgreen@trustedadvisor.com. And what's really interesting is the Trusted Advisor book is one of three in a series. I refer to trust-based selling all the time, and the Trusted Advisor field book are all three bestsellers. And they're timeless. They're classics. And they have stuff in there that you and your colleagues should be listening to. So thanks again for joining us for 10 Minutes With. Thanks to Charles Greene. And we'll catch you the next time on 10 Minutes With.